Just retracking for a minute on appliances, you, when I asked about them, you only mentioned the refrigerator. Did you have things like Mixmasters and electric jugs?
No, we didn't have many what I'd call gadgets these days that you tend to take for granted. I certainly wouldn't have had a Mixmaster. I wouldn't never have had a juicer, because you'd just do that on a glass juicer over a cup, you know. And I wouldn't have had an electric jug. Probably the radio was as modern as I got for quite some time.
Vacuum cleaner?
Yes, I'd have had a vacuum cleaner, and I had a carpet sweeper that I used to use probably more than the vacuum cleaner. But we just didn't have those sort of appliances. I don't think it occurred to me to have them. I don't think they were a priority. And when we got the Victor motor mower, that was big time too, because we'd had a hand push mower for years before that.
And what about television when that came?
Yeah, well, probably television was around for 10 or more years before we got a television set. It wasn't a high priority. We were a very musical family, and my husband plays piano and clarinet and anything else that he wants to. And the eldest boy plays French horn, guitar, saxophone and piano. They all play piano. Jenny played flute, and they all play guitar. And we sang a lot. That was our activity with the family, was singing around the piano. And it was always the grandparents that came always played and sang, so that it was a usual thing to happen and not something. And one of the nice offshoots of that is that we can now just sit down and play and sing anywhere and really enjoy it. Nobody's judgmental about that's really terrible or any of that. It's just fun. And it's a lovely offshoot. It really is good. And reading poetry. We used to read a lot of poetry, the children and my husband and I, out on the back step on the hot summer nights, just sitting there looking at those beautiful sunsets, magnificent in the west. They're all pink and orange, and always have been, and long, they last a long time. And we'd sit out the back in the garden, put the hose on, and just read poetry. It was lovely.
What about health services in the area? Was there a local hospital?
Yes, Blacktown Hospital was there, but that's really all there was, and that's where you went if you were sick. And in fact, that was one of the turning points also about learning to drive, was that my husband had an ulcer in those days, and he was very ill one night, and I didn't know how to get him to a doctor, and we had no phone, so that it was really isolated, and knowing that I didn't know how I could physically get him anywhere. So you don't. I mean, you just deal with it until the light of day. And it was shortly after that that I started to learn to drive.
And did you have access to a local doctor?
No, he was at the hospital. Oh. There wasn't a local doctor. There were several local doctors, but they kept very short hours. And no one ever gets sick in open hours. But the doctors that had been there for a lot of years, and mainly were husband and wife teams, and they just saw to the, you just, when you went shopping, you went to the doctor and did all that thing, and the council did all the immunisation for the children and all of those clinics, and the baby health centre was there. It was a Tresillian, I think, in Patrick Street, and it was there probably most of my life there. The baby health centre was the place that everybody went to whenever there were problems with the kids.
Was there a local ambulance service or anything like that?
Not for a lot of years. Mm. And there is now, but there weren't for a lot of years. There was nothing of that type there that functioned as such. Maybe we didn't have the thought to use it in the same way then as you do now. We just went to the hospital if there was a problem.
And what about when your children were born? Did you have your children at the local hospital?
No, I had them at Crown Street because I'd had three of them before I moved there, so I only had Danny. But in fact, when I'd been in to visit my mother in hospital at Marrickville one night, and we'd driven out to Blacktown at the end of the day with all the children, and as we got to the driveway, I said to my husband, "Don't get out, take me back." So I went back in and had Danny that night. So he hadn't been out of the car since 4 o'clock that morning, and here it was, you know, nearly 4 o'clock the next morning. And we'd just been in and out of Blacktown twice from the city.
I'm going to ask you, did you plan, when you got married, did you plan to have four children?
Oh, no. That I didn't plan to have four children when I had four children. No, they were all accidental. The pill didn't come out till after Danny was born. And that's when the pill came on the market, was that was my last child. But we'd used all forms of contraception prior to that, and all very unsuccessfully. So that, I suppose, they keep you non-pregnant for a short period of time. Otherwise, I guess I'd have had four in 4 years. But
so you didn't have a lot of control over.
No, and I didn't have a lot of knowledge of contraception either, and neither did my husband. I think we were both fairly illiterate about that sort of thing. And it wasn't until after Danny, the fourth child, that I actually went and did a whole lot of reading about it. I think I assumed it would all take care of itself. Somebody told me that I couldn't fall pregnant while I was breastfeeding, which is why the two children, the first two, are 11 months apart. So much for don't fall pregnant. But yes, it's... And Dr. Carr and his wife were the doctors that I used to see there in Flushcombe Road, and they were an institution in the place for looking after the women and children around the area.
And what about the churches? You did mention the choir. Were there other churches in the area, and did they play an important social role for women in the area?
Oh, very much so. And I mean, even for someone who was an atheist like I was, I mean, my life was very much entwined in the church there. I'd had a convent upbringing before I'd come to the conservatorium, and so those ties were there anyway. But the St Patrick's Catholic Church in Patrick Street was a centre for everything, all sorts of activities. Sometimes the immunisation clinics were there. Certainly any visiting speaker of any sort was there. They used to do a midweek mass with guitar and folk music at some stage. I can't remember when that was, but I know that I found the music of that absolutely fantastic. The priests all had push bikes, of course, and used to pedal around. I had fostered isn't exactly the term. I'd looked after a number of children that the church had placed with me who were either beaten or abandoned on a temporary basis, and then later on the littlies were replaced with drug addicts that were in the process of going somewhere, or children who kept attempting suicide and that they'd taken from their parents. And I initially refused to do it because I thought I had enough of my own children and enough to do. But Father Grew, who was the parish priest there at the time, was very persuasive and kept saying things like, just for today, you take this one just for today and I'll find a home for them tomorrow, but I can't take them back to their father tonight or he'll kill them. And so it grew and grew from that there seemed to be always a lot of children on the way out. I had one little boy who'd just seen his father shoot his mother in front of him, and he was 8. I had another young girl that had tried to commit suicide all the time, until I finally had to say to her, I can't handle you. If you really want to die that badly, you've got to kill yourself, because I can't be a policeman to you anymore. And I mean, she's just the most beautiful young woman these days. And when I said it, I sat there when she left and cried and vomited and thought, what have I done? But I didn't know how to handle it anymore. But she's fine. It just shook her up, and the thought that I might abandon her. And she just went away and got her act together, but that was because of the church. I mean, they were very supportive of the kids.
The church really played a role in community services.
Well, Father Grew would come and get me, and we'd go down to the police station and retrieve somebody, some 15-year-old girl out of the cells that had been thrown in there drunk and that sort of stuff. You know, it was, while it didn't happen every day, it certainly happened every few months. I did that probably 4 or 5 years, I suppose, till they found enough people. I was most unwilling. I never even wanted to do it. I felt totally unqualified to do it. But it filled a role at the time.
Were you involved in any other organisations or clubs apart from the ones you've mentioned, any, you know, the Red Cross or...
I think I've probably been instrumental in setting up most of the cultural organisations out there at some stage or another. And we brought in a choreographer and had them employed by Blacktown Council at one stage as a choreographer in residence to unite the multicultural groups out there in dance festival. So that, because they all worked very independently of each other and didn't speak to one another, and yet they did the most beautiful work. So Margaret Walker came in and unified them all. She'd had a lot of experience in multicultural dance, both here and overseas, and put together a team of professional dancers. So we actually had our first professional dance group called Blacktown Dancers out there for 10 years as well. And there were all sorts of the macrame group, and then we set up another one in Mount Druitt, a branch of it at the library there, that used to have 60 or 70 people as members of that. The art and craft group had 600 to 700 members at one stage. It's fallen off now because there are so many things available. But it was a reflection of how desperate people were to be creative and do something creative. The Red Cross and all of those, the View Club as a member of all of those, and the Smith family. And because I used to sing at most of their functions as some sort of entertainment, and the hospital auxiliary. And everybody belonged to all of those. There weren't that many of us.
So you all knew each other.
Mm.
And so when you look at the area, then you see massive changes that have taken place in the time you were there. What's your impression of how the landscape's changed?
Mm. Well, they did, for a long time, they did really terrible things architecturally. They kept bulldozing everything and putting up a car park at the drop of a hat. And that was pretty devastating because everything that had any sort of character or trees around it or you know, anything that was a monument of past seemed to go, and that everything became very sterile. And it was, people had a lot of problems adjusting to an area that they couldn't relate to anything in. Also, of course, they brought in huge floods of people, like 1,000, 30,000 people. At one stage, the population of Mount Druitt was 90,000, 60,000 of whom were under the age of 15. So it was like having a giant kindergarten suddenly plonked in the middle of the area with no facility, no postal, no telephone, and people were just suiciding like crazy out there.
No postal service either?
No, well, not in... You couldn't just go down the street and post a letter. You'd have to catch the bus or whatever, or walk into Mount Druitt and do all the business there. There was the old shopping centre there before the new one came. But really, there were very few facilities. And also, they put people together, like the Serbs and Croatians, who traditionally hadn't spoken to each other for thousands of years, and in fact were very violent to one another. They put all the old people in certain streets. All the people with 9 children got the 5-bedroom houses in other streets. So you could actually never get away from your problem. If you were old and couldn't open your window because it was stuck, neither could the person next door because they were old as well. If you had 9 children and were going round the bend, you couldn't get away because the people next door had 9 as well. And so it was really terrible planning without facilities. Blacktown Council then undertook a pilot project called Section 94, where we took the developers to court to have them contribute so much from every block of land towards community facilities. And we won that. And that was a really big, like 2.5-3 year court battle for that to happen. And we all of the service, community services people, surveyed every aspect of the area, from where you want your bus stop to how many children and why do they play on the road. And it was observed at the time that children in housing commission areas like to play on the road. Well, that's rubbish. There was only the road. Yeah, so that a lot of the myths were shot down during that this 94 case. So it was an important landmark for us out there for community development, because also after that came estate workers, new estate workers. Facilities went in before the people went in. the bus service was lined up to go in with the first resident in the area, so that by the time Minchinbury came along and St Clair, those things and Doonside were taken for granted. The Toongabby development is a very interesting one to look at because it had enormous problems, and Garage Graphics, which is a women's silk screen cooperative in Mount Druitt, undertook a huge social campaign of posters and negotiation with the Housing Commission, and we actually had the architecture of that Toongabby development changed, which was a monumental thing to happen because of the impact the posters had had throughout the area. And a lot of social change came about because of Garage Graphics, because they could publicise a whole lot of things that and communicate that to people settling into the new areas that weren't there before. But it was a good place to live, and it was open and airy, was challenging. Nothing was easy. But it was easy also to win victories, to gain benefits, once people got together and knew to do that. So it developed enormously. I don't see a lot of change in it now. I mean, there is to the 50s, but there isn't to the 70s. It hasn't gone far. No, I don't think so. I think it took on a character in the 70s that will stay with it, I think, for quite some decades to come. But those early years were only marked by the isolation and the lack of facility, the lack of planning. I mean, Blacktown just grew up all over the place. It didn't actually get planned all that hard. And John Aquilina, when he was mayor out there, who's now the Shadow Minister for Education, he would have been the single most important person that I'm aware of to bring changes about. He was a high school teacher up at Mount Druitt at the time, teaching history, and he lobbied for all sorts of changes and actually made them happen. He's a man with vision. The other thing I forgot to say was that my husband, after he left the bus company, joined the waterfront and was part of the waterside workers, and then I became secretary of the Women's Federation of Waterside Workers. And during a lot of the strikes of those late 50s, mid-60s, I toured around Australia speaking on behalf of women of waterside workers on why they were out on strike, and went to conferences in Queensland and in Victoria representing the Waterside Workers Federation. And that was also paid for by that strawberry picking that we talked about earlier.
Well, thank you very much, Pat. It's been very interesting, and I've enjoyed talking with you.